All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1.
What's up, everybody? This is the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Yeah, I'm supposed to bring Jeremy in. Jeremy, you go ahead and do better than I do.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, the future of AT education. We are talking with, according to Dr. Josh Ellen, the smartest man he knows, Dr. Mark Merrick, the Buckeye professor. So, Dr. Mark Merrick, welcome.
Thank you. It's always great to be here. And if I'm the smartest person Yellen knows, he needs to meet a better class.
I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. Of course, we got Dr. Josh Yellen. And just to test you out, why don't you introduce your students with us?
To the left is... to the left is Sahifa Ansari. She's a second-year MAT student. She is currently assigned to the Houston Dynamo Academy. Right, so we have the Houston Dynamo, Jose Chavez is there, and then Houston Dynamo Academy. And then to her left is Melanie Kwok. Melanie Kwok is a second-year MAT student with us, and her current assignment is with UH Men's Basketball.
All right, well, welcome. Thanks for joining us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/the future. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/the future. So we're talking about the future of athletic training education. So Dr. Mark Merrick just recently released was the new practice analysis, correct?
Well, so the BOC, the Board of Certification, recently released what's called practice analysis, right? So it used to be what's called the 6th edition role delineation study and practice analysis. Now it's just the 7th edition practice analysis. And so some of those, the domains have changed up slightly. Like, for instance, you'll see the first domain where it was injury and illness prevention and wellness protection. Now it's injury and illness prevention and wellness promotion. The 5th domain, which is where my life kind of exists, is rather than professional development, well-being, like, you know, health and well-being of the organization, it's back to healthcare administration, professional responsibility. And then the others have remained pretty consistent throughout. We've gone to some other terms like therapeutic intervention, which is a more appropriate term rather than saying therapeutic modalities, rehab, pharmacology. Therapeutic intervention is a comprehensive categorization of that. Yeah, so that came out from the BOC.
All right.
Yep.
So, Dr. Mark Merrick, why don't you go ahead and... You start. I know Yellen said you've done 2 presentations on this before that he's heard. So why don't you just go ahead and get us started with the athletic training education of the future.
Okay. A couple of thoughts here. One, the talk that Josh has referred to is a talk that Katie is giving at every district meeting. And it's literally on it's called Shaping the Future of Athletic Training Education. So we've delivered it at the EATA meeting. We've delivered it at the Joint Committee meeting. We delivered it at the Athletic Training Educators Conference 2 weeks ago. I'm giving it next week at GLADA. In addition to myself, Mickey Cuppett, who's our executive director at the KD, and Dr. Leslie Taylor, who is the president-elect of the KD, will also be giving that talk at different district meetings. You know, with 10 districts, we've divided it up between the 3 of us because we fly enough as it is. So trying to get to every district with each of us is a little bit tough. So I'm not going to go through that entire talk here. What we are in the process of doing is actually recording a web version of that talk that we'll have up on our website here probably in the next week or 10 days. So folks will be able to access that at any time and do that. But maybe I will try to hit a few of the highlights from that talk. And certainly at any time as we're going through here, I'm certainly happy to answer questions and talk about anything that you might have an interest in talking about. And if you remind me at the end, I might even have some interesting news to share on the international front, because that was originally going to be the topic of this talk, and we didn't think we'd be far enough down the road internationally to really do a full talk on international. But that's on the horizon, so I'll throw a little tease for you there.
Mark, in addition to giving the talk at all the districts, will you also be giving the talk at the NATA?
Hopefully, by the time we get to NATA, we'll still have just a couple of districts after that. What I think we'll do with the Katie's time at the NATA is really do more of an open forum session. We haven't fully planned that programming yet, but we are working with our strategic partners on space. As you may or may not know, you know, at the NATA meeting, NATA controls the space for, you know, who's in which session, which time, which room, those kinds of things. And we are, you know, last year when we did some open forums, we were often a secondary hotel setting rather than actually in the convention center. And that was not that wasn't ideal for those sessions. So we're working to see if we can't do a little better with those. But we'll probably have more of a Q&A and an open forum there, because we anticipate that before NATA, we'll have an open comment period going on the next edition of the educational competencies. And I think people are probably going to want to talk about those a little bit more than the talk that we would have been rolling out quite a bit before then. So probably won't do this talk at NATA, although we might. We'll have to see a little bit of what that landscape holds as we get a little bit closer to that. It's still, you know, still a good 3.5 months off. But as we talk about the future of athletic training education, the thing that we try to do with this talk is to talk about the why. Last year, we released the open comment on the educational competencies, the educational content, as well as a separate but overlapping open comment on the operational standards for accredited professional programs. We put that out there. You saw a lot of the what. I think a lot of people didn't understand the how of that, how that was developed, nor the why behind why some of the changes that were there. So, you know, hopefully I'll get into that a little bit. I think maybe a good place to start is you mentioned the practice analysis, and practice analysis 7, which just came out from the BOC here not all that long ago, is a description of current practice of the athletic trainer. And if you understand the way the practice analysis process works, is the BOC puts together a group of athletic trainers in a lot of different settings, and they ask them, what do you do right now? And they use that information to formulate the practice analysis, which is a description of the current practice of athletic training. And it serves the basis for the certification exam, as well as really the defining, maybe the defining metric of what we do as athletic trainers right now on a national scope. That's a little different than what we do in education. In education, rather than talking about preparing the practitioner of today, we have to look ahead to preparing the practitioner of tomorrow. So currently, education, not just currently, but currently and historically, our education has always had to be out in front of where the current practice analysis and where the current state practice acts are. For example, there are a lot of state practice acts right now that still define the practice of athletic training as care of athletes and athletes only. And, you know, that's a real barrier to practice in some settings. In fact, a number of our states are in legislative efforts and in some cases legislative battles trying to work on what kind of patients are they allowed to treat. But our educational standards for athletic trainers haven't been limited to just athletes in, oh gosh, forever. And we actually require that every graduate of an accredited athletic training program have clinical exposure and experience with non-athlete patients. So there's a place where we are already out ahead of a lot of state practice acts and have been for quite a while. Same thing is true of the phrase diagnosis. You know, we talk about clinical diagnosis in athletic training, and you know, for my whole early professional career, we never used the D word. Athletic trainers don't diagnose, we evaluate or we assess or we form an impression or whatever other euphemism you want for the word diagnosis. And then, you know, a few years back, we kind of went, you know what? What we do is actually called a diagnosis. And we started using that term, and it appears in quite a few places, but there's still a lot of states who can't use the word diagnosis and are currently fighting over that. So AT education is typically out in front of where current practice is. And it needs to be that way, because what we're doing is we're preparing the provider of tomorrow for tomorrow. And that's sort of the framework that it's useful to think about the educational content in. What will the athletic trainer of tomorrow need? And when we talk about what the athletic trainer of tomorrow needs, I think a piece of that is understanding what the healthcare landscape looks like tomorrow. And that's an area where I think a lot of athletic trainers either haven't had a lot of exposure or haven't had a lot of background or a lot of opportunity to think in that way. So that's really a big piece of what the talk that we've delivered at ATEC and we'll have up on the website talks about. It's a little bit of that framework. So I'll see if I can't hit a few highlights from that to maybe give a little bit of context. Right now, about 75% of accredited professional athletic training programs are housed in academic units where they're not other healthcare providers there. Kinesiology, exercise science, colleges and schools of education, lots of places where you might be the only athlete or the only healthcare provider in your entire academic structure. And in those situations, a lot of times you don't get the professional socialization into healthcare that you might get if you were, say, in a school of health sciences or a college of medicine or a school of nursing or a place with other healthcare providers. But in the absence of some of that framework, you miss the conversations that are happening on the bigger level in healthcare education. And I became a little more attuned to these just about a year ago when we had the opportunity to join the Institute of Medicine's Global Forum on Health Professions Education. The Global Forum is, well, it's just that. It's a global forum. It is health professions educators from around the globe. So it's not just U.S.-centric. There are folks from Europe. There are folks from Africa. There are folks from Canada, Mexico, South America. So it's an international group who sits down and talks about what are the big issues in health and how do we address them with health professions education. And we've never been at that table before. In fact, 2016 was the very first time athletic training had ever been a part of the Global Forum. It's a situation that we partnered with NATA and BOC and in spirit with the foundation as well as a strategic alliance and sponsored a membership spot on the Global Forum so athletic training could be at the table. And while we're there, we're talking about things like the social determinants of health and the IHI triple aim and how does education help change the health problems that we have in the world.
Mark, can I interject here? For those that don't understand what the IHI triple aim is, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that a lot of us have never really heard of. I'm looking for my triple aim slide here so that I can – I've got all of my notes on it. The triple aim is something that was it came out of the bigger conversation in health. It's been out here for just a few years, but the triple aim is originally published in 2007 from the Institute for Health Improvement, and it's a pretty simple concept when you think about it. The triple aim of health is: what is the big goal of healthcare? And the three parts of that aim are population health, experience of care, and per capita cost. And the population health side, you notice I didn't say healthcare, I said health. The goal is to improve the health of the population. And when we do it right, that involves a lot more preventative kinds of things rather than treating with illness and disease after it happens. We can put interventions in place to keep people healthier, that's even better. And prevention is certainly not something that's new to the athletic trainer, but we maybe haven't thought about it on a population scale. But the goal is to improve health, to prevent disease, to have better access and better systems of care, and even to address some of the social determinants of health. And if you're not familiar with social determinants of health, social determinants of health are the factors that determine your health outcome that are based on a lot of environmental factors. For example, at the Global Forum, we talked about two zip codes in Boston. And these two zip codes are 5 miles apart, but the life expectancy difference in those two zip codes is 30 years different. And that is after you adjust for violence. So massive, massive differences in health outcomes. There's huge disparities there. So the population health side is we want to improve the health of the population, not just the care that they receive. The experience of care, which is the second part of the triple aim, is about patient-centered and culturally competent care. We need to be able to have our care focus on the patient and the patient's needs and make the primacy of the patient a really important goal in how we do healthcare. And patient-centered care is something that we've been talking about at the Katie for a long time. It's been an IOM core competency you know, since, for 13 or 14 years now.
Do you guys know what the IOM is?
Institute of Medicine.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
They recently changed names to the National Academy of Medicine, but they've still kept the. We sometimes still use IOM because that document with the core competencies was published under the IOM. But the experience of care is not just about patient-centered care. It's also about culturally competent care. And that is something that we are becoming more and more attuned to. Not every patient's needs can be met in the same way and in a way that is culturally sensitive and appropriate to what they need. There's things like improved approach and delivery of care, and improved patient experience, and improved quality. Quality improvement is a massive focus in healthcare right now that we've really just started to scratch the surface on in athletic training. The third piece of the triple aim is the per capita cost. The U.S. healthcare program, the way our healthcare system works right now, is not sustainable. We spend more per capita and have lower outcomes than most of the rest of the first world nations that we take a look at. And those are systematic problems, not small scale, large scale. And whether you are in favor of it or against it, the Affordable Care Act was not just an attempt at access to care for patients, but it was also an attempt to fundamentally change the healthcare system to try to address some of those things. And the things that were in that act really covered the entire spectrum of the system and reached almost every part of it, which is why I think the current Congress is having so much difficulty on trying to figure out can and if they are able to remove it and replace it with something else, because there are so many tentacles of that act. But the per capita costs piece has to look at improving efficiency. It has to look at things like managed care. You've seen a lot more emphasis in managed care in the last few years, which is really actually good for us because athletic trainers were managed care before managed care was cool. We've always had a group of people who we take care of, and we do whatever that group of people needs. We didn't really work in our traditional settings on a per patient and per procedure billing basis. We simply got a lump sum, our salary, and our budget for supplies, and we took care of the people in front of us. That's really essentially what managed care is. And that's an area where I think that we have the ability to help others see how to do that. I think we're not tapping into that nearly as well as we maybe could. When you look at the managed care world and the per capita cost, for us to deliver the kind of care that's going to be needed, we already have a physician shortage. And that physician shortage is getting worse, not better, particularly in areas like primary care. And I'll talk about primary care in a moment. But in order to extend the care net to everybody who needs care, those physicians need to partner with multi-skilled non-physician providers. And that's a recommendation out of the IHI Triple Aim paper. And guess what, folks? Athletic trainers are multi-skilled non-physician providers. It's exactly who we are. And there's a nice role looking at the healthcare spectrum ahead if we're willing to step in and try to fill it. So the last piece of the triple aim is about per capita cost and a value model. The outcomes that you get versus the cost of the care that you provide. I don't know about you, but I grew up as an athletic trainer thinking that, you know, a budget is what other people had. And what I had is a group of patients and finding a way to get them the care they needed and doing it as inexpensively as we could. And that's certainly how I had to do it as a high school athletic trainer back in the day. Certainly how I saw it done in small universities where I had exposure. And even at a place like Ohio State where I am now, where we're, you know, on the athletic side, if we want something, we buy it. We have the resources, but we still look for ways to do things efficiently. And that value, that outcome for the cost is something that athletic trainers are really good at. So that's sort of the triple aim. When we look at the triple aim in the big picture, how does an athletic trainer help to achieve that triple aim? And, you know, as we look at trying to do that, I think it's really valuable to understand the concept of primary care. In fact, I have a couple of slides on this in that talk. And one of the slides says, athletic trainers provide patient care that fits in the umbrella of primary care. But I usually write about that point, have everybody raise their hand and say, how many of you have ever described yourself as a primary care provider? And usually it's a handful of hands, usually less than a fourth of the room, because it's not language that we've ever learned to use. The
Mark, can you give a definition? You know, in these talks, you've given a really good definition of what primary care is. And I think when you do that, and then you look at the definition of athletic training, they really merge very well together.
I think it's compelling. The definition of primary care that I use in these talks is one that anybody could go look up right now. It takes 5 seconds. It's from the American Academy of Family Physicians, the AAFP. And if you just Google AAFP primary care, you'll land on this definition. And I've got it pulled up here in front of me, so I will read it. But when you read it, I want you to think about, what do I do as an athletic trainer, and does it sound like this? So here's the AAFP definition of primary care. Primary care is that care provided by physicians specifically trained for and skilled in comprehensive first contact and continuing care for persons with an undiagnosed sign, symptom, or health concern. They call that the undifferentiated patient. And they're not limited by problem origin, whether that be biological, behavioral, or social, organ system, or diagnosis. So that's the first part. So the three elements in there, we do first contact care, as in I'm often the first person this patient sees. Does that sound like us in athletic training? Mm-hmm. We treat whatever just walked in the door, and we're often the first provider that somebody sees. We also do continuing care. In fact, in many cases, our care is across the span of multiple years. And for people who are previously undiagnosed, the undifferentiated patient, again, whatever just walked in your door, regardless of the origin of that problem. We certainly see a ton of musculoskeletal, but I recently had a conversation with a director of athletic training at a Division I university who tracks their data. Looks specifically at what's every case that they treated in their facility over the course of the last year. And he told me that their data show that 1/3 of what they treat in their athletic training room was non-orthopedic. So absolutely, we do these kinds of things. Now, if we look at the rest of the definition, it starts to tease out a little bit of the roles. So let me read the rest of this for you. It says, primary care includes health promotion, disease prevention, health maintenance, counseling, patient education, diagnosis and treatment of acute and chronic illnesses in a variety of healthcare settings. Well, that sounds a lot like what we do. The next piece says, primary care is performed and managed by a personal physician. And I think that that's important. The primacy of the physician in primary care is essential. But it goes on to say, managed by the personal physician, often collaborating with other health professionals. That is, the physician isn't the only one rendering the primary care. They oversee it, they manage it, they coordinate it, but other healthcare professionals are involved in that primary care program. They use consultation and referral as appropriate. Primary care provides patient advocacy in the healthcare system to accomplish cost-effective care by coordination of healthcare services. I think many times we have described ourselves as being the hub of the wheel in the sports medicine care that we often provide. That is, we see a patient, we refer them to the other people, we coordinate between multiple providers, and that's exactly what's at the heart of this. The very last part says, primary care promotes effective communication with patients and encourages the role of the patient as a partner in healthcare. Again, all of those things, as I read this definition a couple years ago, I went, that is entirely what we do. That is athletic training. And it's not a new focus. One of the questions that we got at the educators conference is, where does this new focus on primary care come from? And the reality is this isn't a new focus. It's just a new term to describe what we've been doing since the foundation of the NATA. So that's sort of the primary care idea.
Dr. Mayer, can I interrupt?
Sorry, go ahead.
I have a question. So currently in the job search, I look and I can see positions for athletic trainers in orthopedic clinics and sports medicine clinics. Do you see a spot for us in a general primary care clinic or in any other specialty?
There already are. It's not uniform. It's not nationwide probably at this point. But there are quite a few primary care physicians who are using athletic trainers within their traditional physician practice. I had the benefit in Columbus, Ohio, of having access to a lot of really good primary care sports medicine practices. And quite a few of those have full-time athletic trainers who are in that practice, and we actually use those as clinical sites for my program. So we'll have students who are out in a physician practice in a primary care setting tends to see a little bit of sports medicine in those settings, but not entirely. You know, they see people who have illnesses, people who have all kinds of different problems that might impact their particular ability to do the things that they like to do, whether that's organized sports or recreational sports or just physical activity. So, you know, if I'm a diabetic, that certainly impacts my ability to engage in physical activity. And they might be seeing that physician, and we've got quite a few athletic trainers who are already in that setting. So it's a great question, but I think we're already there, and I think you're only going to see growth.
And so along the lines of the question that Sahifa just asked, do you see, as we start to talk about transition of practice, do you see more residency programs being developed to address that need in primary care where the student can come out of an entry-level master's, complete a residency program in primary care or sports medicine, and then be able to transition practice into a physician setting?
I think that's a great question. I'm going to address it on a couple of levels. First, every athletic trainer who comes out of an accredited program needs to be able to be minimally competent in any setting in which they want to practice. That's sort of the requirement of professional education. But beyond minimally competent in any setting, sometimes you need to develop specific expertise and go beyond beyond an entry-level practice. And that's what post-professional education is all about. Specifically, the residency programs are something that I think we're going to see a lot of growth. Acadia accredits residency programs, and we've seen a lot of growth there just in the last year, where we've doubled the number of residencies who are now accredited. And I think it will take off. But I think in athletic training, we struggle to understand what residencies are about. You know, residency program is not the new GA. It's not a replacement for a GA. It's not a transition to practice experience. A residency is about, I want to become an expert practitioner in this specialty area. And I would think that primary care would certainly make sense as one of those, just as it would in orthopedics or in rehabilitation. There might be quite a few different areas, and that's actually a conversation that we had at the Katie meeting last weekend, is what are areas that maybe will make sense going forward for residencies to look at, because a lot of programs who are developing residencies are struggling to understand how to define the specialty area. So that's an area we'll probably partner with them on going forward.
And are you able to elaborate just a little bit in some of those areas, not the details of the meeting, but just some of the areas that you think will be growing?
I think I can do that. I probably have that note right here on my desk somewhere. It's a question I wasn't ready for, Josh.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. In addition to Dr. Merrick being the president of the Katie, he's also the program director. So I'm happy to see that all program director desks look all the same.
They all do. We have stuff everywhere. So this is by no means an official and binding list. This is a brainstorming.
Sure.
Kind of a list of areas that might be ripe for residency, but things in prevention and wellness, maybe emergent care or urgent care, primary care, which we've already mentioned, orthopedics, which is what we tend to see a number of our residencies in already. We're seeing orthopedic practices, some of which are actually preparing athletic trainers to do first surgical assist right in the OR. Rehabilitation makes sense. I could maybe see behavioral health as an area. I suspect we might see something in neurology and ultimately related to concussion care, pediatrics, occupational medicine, I think makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Whether performing arts medicine is part of occupational medicine or its own thing, I'm not really sure. Military might fit in there as well. But you know, the thing that's important about those, more than the list, is that residencies are about specific needs of a specific kind of patient. And gaining additional expertise in delivering that kind of care. And a residency is different than professional education. In professional education, we spend a lot of time covering theory and foundation and a lot of time in the classroom, and you follow that up with some clinical practice to kind of make those things real. In residency training, it's not about classroom education, and it's not about some egghead like me from a university standing up and lecturing at you. Residency training is about learning to treat specialty patients by treating specialty patients under the mentorship of somebody who's an expert in that area. So it's clinically practice-based education that has some academic components to it, but the focus is clinical practice training. And it's sort of the reverse of what we see in professional education, where it's mostly academic with some clinical practice thrown in. So it's a little different kind of setting. But yes, to get back roundabout to your question, I think that residencies in primary care make a lot of sense. I think that we'll see a lot of growth in residencies once people figure out what it is and what it isn't. And I think right now, from what I've seen in residencies, there's a lot of disparate quality about them. There are some that are really very good, and there are some who are advertising things that they call a residency that is really just high school sports coverage, and you have to spend a couple hours a week in a clinic. And that's really not a residency. You know, a residency, you have to have a primary focus in the specialty area. You may do some other things as well to round it out, but the focus needs to be in a specialty area and about making a specialty practitioner.
Dr. Merrick, as you were talking about the primary care definition, all of those were saying physician. So for me, like, I'm having a hard time, I guess, translating that to athletic trainer, because it says in there, you know, a primary care, the physician.
Right.
And so how do I make that apply to me, the athletic trainer, the non-physician?
That's a great question. The key to that is understanding a little bit of the bigger picture. The same group who puts out that definition also talks about a primary care physician shortage. In fact, there are several groups who do that. And one of my slides in the talk is from the AAMC, which says that there's a significant primary care and overall physician shortage, and it is getting worse. One of the key elements of that primary care piece was that while the physician, they do it in collaboration with and relying on other providers to help them do it. And certainly the Katie is not proposing that athletic trainers are a replacement for primary care physicians. In fact, I think that it's really important that we keep our care linked to the physicians we're partnered with. I think that that's a strategically important thing that some other healthcare professions have missed. They've tried to go it off on their own, and they've created adversarial relationships in some cases with physician groups. I think we need to partner with the physician group. But as we see a primary care shortage, and that's not just the U.S., by the way, that's global, there's a greater primary care need than there are enough physicians to provide it, which means instead of that physician being able to see every patient who needs them, that physician will have some other providers who work with them to allow them to see jointly between them a larger number of patients in a smaller amount of time. So just like, well, think about your athletic training room. You know, when your team physician, if they're the only person providing the care, you know, when the doc is in the athletic training room, we usually have people queued up to see them, and it takes forever to get them through. But when you have a physician and you have a group of athletic trainers, you know, the athletic trainers are able to provide a lot of that care, and the physician doesn't typically have to see every patient every single visit. Instead, we're able to provide a network of care that allows more patients to be seen and be seen more efficiently under the care and the umbrella and the guidance of that individual or small group of physicians. Sort of the way that it works in primary care is that the physician is the head of this food chain, but they've got a lot of other provider partners who work with them to be able to extend the services that they need to the group of patients who they oversee. I don't know if that helps at all, but that's maybe the way that I've always conceived.
Along those lines, can you give an idea, as we start to extend the services of physicians, can you give an idea to Sahifa and Melanie and Jeremy about some of the, I don't want to misspeak here, but I guess new emerging competencies and proficiencies that are coming about in athletic training in terms of...
I'm trying to walk a very tight line on that. And the reason I want to do that is that there's a committee of really bright folks who are working their tail off, who are putting together the next version of the educational competencies document. And the educational content that is in there, for people who haven't been too familiar with this process, has been a joint effort with two people from the KD, two people from NATA, and two people from BOC. And that group is a steering committee who oversees it. And they have pulled in expertise from practitioners in a lot of different settings to say, what are the things you need and will need in your particular setting? And they took that list and brainstormed it into a set of proposed educational content. And that went out for the open comment last spring. A lot of comment on that, about 1,500 comments. Some of them very thoughtful, very helpful, and very formative. A few of them, not so much. I did find it interesting that there was a page and a half rant on why Hillary Clinton shouldn't be president. I don't know quite what that had to do with our competencies, but it was in there. But that group has taken that feedback and revised that document, and it's very close. I would anticipate that the Katy board will probably get that from the committee here in the next couple of weeks, and we'll take a good hard look at it and share that with the other boards of the other strategic partners, and then we'll be getting that out for an open comment here later in the spring. So I don't want to write a check that they can't cash on this podcast, because I don't want to be too far in front of the document. So I'm going to talk in big generalities rather than saying Merrick proposes this specific content. But we talk about this a little bit in our district talk, and we talk about the changing landscape in which we live. For example, we've been saying that athletic trainers extend the ability of physicians to provide care. You probably noticed that we're not using the word physician extender as a practice setting anymore. It's because athletic trainers extend the services of the physician in every setting, not just in a physician's office. So, but when you look at those settings, well, here's an example I used in the talk. You've probably seen that there are a number of groups working on blood tests for concussion. And if a blood test becomes the definitive standard of care to diagnose a concussion, then your concussed patient or your suspected concussed patient is going to have a blood sample drawn and analyzed. The question is, if that's the way that it works, how does that impact your practice as an athletic trainer? If you haven't been trained in basic phlebotomy, for example, which, by the way, isn't rocket science. It's done by a lot of different healthcare professionals. It's not owned by any one professional. But if you can't draw a tube with a Vacutainer, for example, to send that off to a lab for a test, well, that has to happen somewhere. And if it's not happening in your facility, then you probably have to send your patient somewhere else to get that done, either over to the physician's office where somebody can do it, or maybe to a third-party lab, or you have to bring somebody in who can do those once a week. But in any case, when you do that, you increase the cost of care because you've added another step. You've increased the inconvenience of care because you have a delay in care. You've got to go somewhere else. You've certainly, in most cases, decreased the patient experience because now they have to take more time out of their schedule to go find someone who can do this test. And in some cases, that's even going to be a barrier to somebody's care. Now, we've all worked in a setting where we have people who have low healthcare access and poor insurance quality, or no insurance in some cases. And if you can't do it in your athletic training room, the chances are that they can't afford to have it done. So if you can't draw that, you know, you just worked, well, if you think about the triple aim, we just went against it in every single point. We have not enough access to that care. We have increased the cost. We have decreased the patient experience. And that's sort of antithetical to what things are supposed to do. So, you know, blood tests are one. Another one that I usually like to pick on is casting. You know, I don't know if this will be in the ultimate proposal or not, but I look around at a lot of athletic trainers who, for their everyday job duties and the settings they are in, have to go out and get a third-party certification to do casting because it wasn't something that was taught to them in their program. And it costs them money out of their pocket, typically, to pick up that thing so they can do their everyday job duties. Now, casting is something that there's no reason in the world we shouldn't be teaching that in pretty much every athletic training program that's out there, in my personal view. It's not a hard skill. It looks a lot like the skills we already have with taping and wrapping. We understand principles of immobilization. We understand orthopedics. We understand the relevant anatomy. That's really low-hanging fruit. But it's never been something we've required before. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of skills like that that our patients need and that our physicians would be very thankful if we were able to provide to prevent an extra step in the patient's care. I'm sure that there's plenty of other stuff that's down that road. And I don't want to paint myself into a corner before that document comes out because I'm not the person who's making that document. That's an independent committee working on it. But they've taken the feedback that they got in the open comment. They've made a bunch of revisions, and we'll see another document soon. I think that they're giving good thought to what are the specific skills that make sense right now. Does everything on the menu that an athletic trainer might do have to come in one step? Probably not. But I think that we need to be strategic and forward-looking and say, what do we need in the future practice of athletic training, and how are we going to get it? And because if we don't get it, somebody else will. And I think we have a small window of opportunity right now to position ourselves well in the healthcare market. And if we're not bold enough to do that, then I think we hurt ourselves in the long run.
Mm-hmm. All right. So earlier you were talking about all the duties that an athletic trainer might do in a doctor's office. That sound to me just like a PA, a physician's assistant. And I don't have a clear cut definition of what they do. And, you know, so I can't say you're just trying to make us that. And please forgive me if I'm saying you as in blaming you, but this is trying to make us physician's assistants rather than athletic trainers. What do you say to the people that are saying, look, we are athletic trainers, let's focus on what we do and do it well? I understand what you just said is we have an opportunity to extend our practice, and if we don't take it now, then we're going to miss out, right? So I understand that part, but how do you respond to those people that say that?
Well, the first thing I would say is we often have this mentality that we have to have permission from other professions to do anything. That, oh, we can't do that. That's a nurse's job. We can't do that. It's a PA's job, or that's a PT's job. But the reality in healthcare is the care that's provided to the patient overlaps between a lot of different professions. For example, we already know that we overlap pretty largely with physical therapy on things like musculoskeletal rehabilitation. I think there's certainly some overlap with PA, but I think there are differences as well. You know, I think if you worked purely in a primary care office, your job might look very much like what a PA might do in that particular setting. But I think we also bring a knowledge and a skill set that is unique to athletic training, and that by no means should we push that off and forget about it. You know, we bring specific understanding and continuity of care with our patients, and specific knowledge of the needs and demands of those patients that a PA might not have. You know, you understand your patient and the things that they're engaged in on a level that most other providers can't begin to understand. The implications of their healthcare condition on the other things they do in their life in terms of physical activity and sport is really very unique to us, at least on the depth that we have it. So I think there's certainly some overlap. You know, some of these skills would overlap with PA, some would overlap with nursing, some would overlap with medical laboratory science. Some would overlap with, you know, being an orthotech or a medical assistant. But, you know, overlaps are inevitable and they always happen in care. The real thing that defines you is what kind of patient are you working with and what are the services that patient needs? So I'm a little less worried about trying to make us into something else, because I've never envisioned it that way. What I've envisioned it as is, this is the group of patients in front of me, and here are the services that they need. Which ones can I provide, and which ones do I have to have somebody else provide? And are there any services out there that would make sense for me to be able to provide to meet the needs of my patients? So I don't know that we're looking at delving out into a whole new group of patients or a whole new different setting. I think it's a matter of what are the services that my current patients need? And what are they going to need going forward? And I think that is where we're starting to see some of the change in healthcare.
Along those lines, Mark, do you see the athletic trainer being able to prescribe? And a second part of that question is, do you see a need for the athletic trainer being able to do that?
So by prescribe, I'm assuming you mean prescribe legend drugs or pharmaceuticals.
Correct. Correct. Legend drugs.
I don't think that was ever the intent of the comments or the proposal that went out last year, but I think the wording was vague enough that it was unclear, and a lot of people have commented on that issue. A lot of people have called me personally on that issue to try to seek some clarification, and a few people just like to rant. But I don't think prescription is what we need. Someday, 30, 50 years down the road, who knows what we will need, but I don't see that as something on the immediate horizon by any stretch of the imagination. I think that our partnership with the physician is such that in most cases, you know, you can talk to the doc and the doc can prescribe what needs to be delivered to that patient. But I think we do have a glaring hole in how well we're trained to administer those medications when the doc orders them. You know, for example, in my program, you know, we've taught basic medication administration for a number of years. A lot of programs don't teach that. I think that there are some discretionary use medicines that make sense for athletic trainers in emergent situations. For example, I think every athletic trainer needs to be able to do discretionary use of an EpiPen. And I think most people would probably tend to agree with that one. I would say the same thing for glucagon. If I have a diabetic patient who's really, really low and unresponsive and can't swallow, you know, I would think the glucagon makes sense. We had a case of that a number of years ago here. We had a team on a road trip, and one of our diabetic athletes went hypoglycemic pretty severely overnight. They had a hard time waking him up, and he was really combative, and he needed the glucagon injection. Unfortunately, he had a glucagon kit with him, but I think that's something maybe every athletic trainer needs. Certainly things like albuterol inhalers. So I think that there's a defined set that makes sense for discretionary use in an emergency. But I think beyond those kinds of things, I think that prescribing authority is not the right fit for athletic trainers. I think that administering those medications is an important skill set that we don't teach consistently enough. And that's an area I personally put more emphasis on than prescribing authority.
Dr. Merrick, to clarify what the role of an athletic trainer in a primary care office would be,
mm-hmm.
If I'm a patient and I come in with a complaint that an athletic trainer can take care of, maybe mm-hmm. I'll be seen by an MA first, then the athletic trainer, and perhaps never the physician?
I don't know about never.
Mm-hmm.
What I think we see in some of the settings where my students are involved in doing this is they're actually, in a lot of cases, not using an MA. They're using an athletic trainer right from the start. Or that athletic trainer is rooming the patient. They're doing the initial workup. So they're doing the basic pieces of the history and physical exam. And then as the physician comes through, they talk with the physician, explain the case, explain their findings. The physician confirms them. They converse on a course of care, and then they implement that course of care. So that's a little bit more of what I'm seeing. But I think that that's going to be practice by practice on what that physician's comfortable with, what that athletic trainer has the skills and the knowledge and the expertise to be able to do. So, you know, I think that that's not a uniform answer right now. And I think that there are areas where athletic trainers do a lot more than that. I think there are also plenty of areas where athletic trainers are functioning nowhere near the level of knowledge and skills that their training has prepared them to do. And I find that a little bit disheartening, and I think that's an area where we need to grow into.
Dr. Merrick, I have a question for you. So I've heard that some athletic trainers are kind of in the like a old school setting or mindset. And how do you feel about that with like the development of AT education and like CEUs and all that just becoming a new something for future athletic trainers, like the younger generation, that were like, okay, I think we understand it, but the old school ones, they kind of don't, and they kind of are hesitant to approach change. Like, how would you deal with those that don't want to change, essentially?
Change is hard, and it's uncomfortable, and a lot of times we wonder if it's worth it, and it's not fast. Now, seldom do we see landmark change in a single generation of practitioners. We see change creep in a direction over time. I think when we look at change, and this is true of change across the board, but certainly true in athletic training education, I think we need to ask ourselves, why is change needed, and is change needed? Can we be who we have always been? Well, I would argue that, you know, I've been certified for 25 years, and when I look at the practice of athletic training from the day that I got my ATC credential to now, it's dramatically different. Change is going to happen inevitably. The question is, will we embrace it and prepare for it, or will we stick our head in the sand and let it pass us by? You know, when we want to propose change, particularly in education, it is an area, maybe more than any other that I've seen, that really gets under people's skin. People take it very, very personally when we want to change the way that we prepare an athletic trainer. And I think sometimes that's people misunderstand it as a condemnation of the way that they were trained. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've had someone of my generation or older say, well, you know, I was trained in the internship model and I'm a good athletic trainer. So I don't see why we needed to have curriculum programs. Well, you know, the data are pretty compelling at this point that the move to curriculum programs has really improved the overall quality and consistency of people sitting for the certification exam. I can remember when the passing rate on the BOC exam was typically in the 50s, occasionally in the 40s. It just went over 80% this year. So we got a lot better consistency there with that. That was a change that was so heavily resisted that I actually know of a person or two who was on the committee who ultimately proposed that, who actually received death threats.
Oh, wow.
Which is amazing. So I look now at when people are worried about the controversies, and no one's threatened my life yet that I know of. So I think we're improving. But the change piece, the matter of showing people how your practice has already changed and getting folks to look at what are the skills that I need and do they match what I used to have? Now, why do we do continuing education? I'll ask you guys. You guys are students. You're entering this world. Why do we do continuing education after you get your credential?
I believe the reason I actually do take CEUs. I'm a certified pharmacy technician, and so I understand that we have to keep up with concurrent research and patient care and things like that. So I'm assuming as a medical profession, we have to keep up. Any medical profession, I believe, that need to take them in order to be up to date with understanding how to better patient care and in terms of research and evidence-based practice to see better outcomes and protect the patient's overall well-being.
And I agree with that, to keep up with the research and then also the potential to add skills that are perhaps being taught in a curriculum that, because you're out of school, you can get those skills after, like post-educationally, post-professionally.
So then your premise is that the practice changes and evolves almost organically on its own as you go. As we have new research findings, it changes the way that we practice. Well, there you go. There's the answer for why we need to change. The practice changes. Our understanding changes. I don't know a lot of athletic trainers who are still using a tobacco poultice. I was taught to make a tobacco poultice when I was a student.
I don't even know
what that is. You know, a lot of athletic trainers of my generation remember the Kramer ankle wrap roller hanging on the wall in the athletic training room. And using
I had those.
What?
So
we're not doing those now.
Yeah, it used to be that there was a Kramer. It looked like a crank, right? And so before we would tape ankles, there were these cloth kind of. They looked like smaller ACE wraps.
I described them as cloth seat belts.
Yeah, that's what they were, and that's how we would secure ankles. And then when you were like, then that went away, and people still had those cranks, so we used them to roll ACE wraps.
Sure,
and it's a really tight like.
But we don't use those now. You know, tape. The market for purchasing tape has shrunk dramatically, which is why you've seen changes in the sponsorship of NATA by J&J, and that whole market is changing. Because people are getting away from using tape. They're moving into braces. The literature better supports that. The practice changes.
To go back
to that, our education has to change. And sometimes the criticism we get is, well, if we add these things to education, don't we strand the existing practitioner who never had these things that were there? And my answer to that is we need a robust continuing education market to fill in those gaps.
To go to Melanie's question about athletic trainers with the older mindset, we currently sometimes will still hear our preceptors say something like athletic trainers can't diagnose. And I don't think it's a matter of them resisting change so much it is they don't know that we've moved to that. And so aside from CEUs, is there some way we can convey those educational changes to professionals who are not in an educational setting that they are aware of these domain changes?
I think continuing education is a primary means. I think reading things like the NATA news and the range of motion email that comes out, you know, on a pretty much weekly basis that you see. Staying current is staying current, and I think that that helps. But beyond that, I think being an ambassador is very helpful. For example, I teach my students a lot of things in the classroom that in many cases are really on the cutting edge. And in my own area of expertise in acute injury management and modalities, we'll often teach things that, you know what, we just learned this in my lab in the last 6 months and the paper's not even published yet, but we're going to start teaching it because I think it's impactful. So what I usually recommend to my students is when they're working with their preceptors and their preceptor does it in a different way or hasn't heard of this, the first thing is they're never allowed to say, Dr. Merrick says you're doing it wrong. Because all that does is create an inflammatory situation, and then no one likes to be told you're doing it wrong. Instead, I tell my students, when you see that situation, you should say to your preceptor, hey, would you like to know the cool thing we learned about in class about this? And use it as an opportunity to share. And that tends to be a little bit better received message. I don't think it's so much an old school and a new way of thinking. I don't think anybody ever thought of themselves as old school when they were new. You know, every one of us, when we graduated, we were cutting edge and we were contemporary and we were up to date. And some of us never changed after that. And what you really have to do is help those folks along to see where does change make sense and how does it improve the care of the patient. And you ask a very big cultural question there. And the hard part culturally is, who do we want to be? The CADI and the NATA and the BOC and the foundation have talked at length over multiple years about the cultural identity of the athletic trainer as a healthcare provider. But I'll be honest with you, we still have some athletic trainers who don't see themselves in that way. In fact, we even saw some of those comments in the open comment period where we had people specifically say, you know, athletic trainers aren't healthcare providers. We don't need this healthcare focus. And I find that disheartening. I think in many ways we still think of ourselves in an athletics-centered world, but I think that's starting to change and change quite a bit. I think the concussion issue has been a driving force on that, as we see more and more instances where athletics folks with athletic interests are at odds with the best needs of a patient with a concussion, and we see lots of press on that issue. We have seen a recent push from the Autonomous Five conferences on independence of the athletic medical staff from the athletics reporting scheme and the coaching paradigm. And we've even seen a push from NCAA along that lines. I think that world has finally got enough momentum that it's going to start to move. And I hope that somewhere down the road, my student's student has a hard time imagining where, as a healthcare provider, we reported to a coach. Mm-hmm. And our job was dependent upon a coach. And don't get me wrong, I think a lot of coaches are well-meaning folks, and I don't mean to disparage any of them, but I think that there's a conflict of interest situation that has to be avoided. I think we, as athletic trainers, need to have a healthcare-centered view, and the primacy of the patient has got to be the most important thing in that view. So, if you're more interested in the gear that you get and the logo on your shirt instead of the patient on the table, you're thinking in a way that isn't consistent with where the profession is now nor where it's going in the future.
I think a really important factor is when we look at the definition of athletic training. Okay, if I go to the BOC website and I looked at that definition, there is no mention of sports or athletics in that definition. There is a mention of healthcare professional and the roles and responsibilities that we as athletic trainers provide. And if you look at those roles and responsibilities, the profession has a tremendous opportunity, especially as Dr. Merrick has been talking about, the landscape of healthcare, where our first practice domain is injury and illness prevention and wellness promotion. Mm-hmm. And that is population health. That is where the current model of healthcare is and where it's going. And so as a profession, again, I've heard you say a few times that we need to finally move out of the athletic model and into the healthcare model. And once we can finally make that transition, I'm hopeful that the entire athletic training population, and there's 50,000 of us about, that we'll be able to function side by side with all of these other healthcare providers. And me functioning in the athletic training education world, I came from an undergraduate program, Southeastern Louisiana University, where I was there for 9 years, and then I took on this opportunity at University of Houston. And I remember, and it was just a few years ago, fielding all of these questions about why are we moving to an entry-level master's degree? This is going to ruin athletic training. You're going to take away from all of these opportunities that you have in the undergraduate setting, and this is going to be the demise of the profession. And what I figured out through my own discovery and listening to some of the experts like Dr. Merrick and Dr. Cuppet and Dr. Taylor and Dr. Saylor and all these other people that were fortunate enough to be around us, is that all the other healthcare providers that we're side by side with, they're all at graduate level medical education. All the other healthcare providers that we're talking with side by side with, when we bring up issues of interprofessional education, this is nothing new to them. It's fairly new to our profession, but it's not new to them. When we bring up issues of immersive clinical education, whether, you know, our program is set up that you guys can have daily immersive clinical education, this is nothing new to them, but it's fairly new to us. So as Dr. Merrick said, change is very, very difficult, but we have a tremendous opportunity as a profession and as healthcare providers. And to be honest with you, I've made the statement a couple times. Sometimes I think our own, resistance, I think our own lack of progress in our profession is because of our own profession, that we have people that are just resistant to change. And it may be because they don't know how to. They may be because they're not as well informed. It may be because of some other personal reasons. But I think that where you all are, and where all the students are now, you all are in what I think is one of the best times in the profession, because you are emerging as the leaders of what we're going to end up being able to do, and we're going to learn from you.
All right, so kind of to wrap this up and to give you an opportunity to give your little teaser, Dr. Merrick, I feel like what I've taken away is that we are trying to prepare the athletic trainer of tomorrow for the patient of tomorrow, and to improve the overall medical experience by improving the efficiency and the abilities of the athletic trainer, rather than having to send them off to do so many other different things, being able to provide those services to those patients that are in front of you. So I think that's something I heard you say over and over again, is being able to look at the patients in front of me and take care of the needs of the patients in front of me, not just the one need, but the needs of the patient in front of me. Does that seem like a pretty fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's a very good synopsis. You know, I think that those patient needs are things that when we can meet them in a more complete way, we greatly improve efficiency, we improve costs, we improve experience of care, all those things that the triple aim is really focused on.
All right. That helps me out a lot. And then now whenever I get those questions, why are we moving this way? What are we doing? I can see, look, we have to think beyond today. We have to look at how can we improve? How can we do this? And so just the summary that I just got from you today is going to be very beneficial for me. So,
and, you know, along those lines, one other thing I'll throw in before I get to my teaser here. You know, Josh made reference to the master's change. And between the master's change and the enforcement of Standard 11, which is the CASR standard, we were projecting to see some contraction of athletic training programs. And I think that had a lot of people very concerned. And what we have seen is we're not losing programs at the rate we expected that we might. But here's the thing that I find really interesting. We have a whole pile of new institutions wanting to come on board and found a new athletic training program, and they're almost all in schools of health professions. The changes that we've made as a profession over the last several years have now put us on the healthcare education radar of a number of institutions who've never had athletic training before, and they want to put them in their health profession schools. I find that to be an exciting shift in the overall paradigm. In fact, looking at our numbers, we got a pretty good feel on how we look out across the next 3 or 4 years, because programs have to notify us if they're closing and have to have a teach out plan. And, you know, we're expecting that we're going to be down maybe a dozen programs total in a net change with the new ones we have coming on. So that's going to be fewer than 4% program loss, which if somebody had said, you know, back when the master's decision was made, that, you know, across the first 5 years of that decision, you're only going to be down less than 4%, people probably would have said, well, no, that couldn't possibly be. But that's exactly where the numbers are coming out. So here's on to my big tease. Originally, when Jeremy asked me to do this talk, we were going to talk about national picture for athletic training education and might we see internationalization of programs. That's been an initiative of the Katie for some time, and we've partnered along with parallel initiatives running by the International Committee of the NATA, who've been just tremendous, tremendous advocates for the globalization of AT. And We've been working with some universities internationally to take a look at our standards and figure out, well, which ones make sense in a non-U.S. context and which ones don't, and which ones might we have to adjust if we ever go that way. And I think we are far enough down that road now that just this week we have our first commitment from an international program who's going to seek accreditation in athletic training. It's actually the Universidad Camilo José Cela in Madrid in Spain. So,
nice.
And we may have another one that shows up on our list here in the next few weeks to months that's also in Spain. So we're seeing some internationalization and even folks globally looking to partner with us because what we're doing here with athletic training practice, they think makes some sense for their country and would like to adopt some educational standards that better prepare people to do that. So that's a really, really exciting thing that I never expected that we would be this far along in such a short time, because I never even anticipated this just, you know, a month or two ago, the last time we talked on this topic. It's kind of fun. It'll be a few years before they actually get there, and we've got a lot of work to do, but we actually have an international program pursuing accreditation now.
And we have some bilingual students. So
very good.
These may be some opportunities coming up. That's great. Absolutely. That's really exciting.
So what actually, Josh, what I'm thinking is that, you know, when they get far enough down the road, I think that's going to be a really popular site visit that a lot of people might like to do.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, I mean, geez, it's got to be really hard. I got to go to Madrid, Spain, you know. Somebody's got to do it.
Right, and I've written grants with fun.
I think a few of our bilingual folks may find some opportunities as we get there.
Yeah.
I've written grants with fund for Teachers that's like a travel grant. So, you know, if I'm going there to work on my athletic training and on my Spanish, I mean, that just seems like it's a win-win right there.
You know, 2 years ago when we were at ATEC in 2015, I think the University of Hawaii, their site visit was coming up, and there was some conversation of like, oh, I hope I get assigned as a site visitor to the University of Hawaii. That's going to be great. Yeah, so I would imagine that that'll be another hot opportunity.
But, you know, have you imagined things like cross-cultural exchanges and doing student exchanges with another accredited program in another country?
Oh, it's amazing. So we have at the University of Houston here, well, we had an exchange program with the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that in our program, again, I was thinking about as I was walking in this building. You know, we have to take baby steps, right? I got here in 2013, admitted our first class in 2014, got accredited in 2016. And so it's baby steps. I would love an opportunity where we're able to do some exchanges across countries, across, you know, different areas, so we can learn from each other and we can open this up internationally. One of the things that we see at NASA is that we have two full-time athletic trainers at NASA, and they're classified as part of the Astronaut Strength Conditioning Rehabilitation Group. But there are no other athletic trainers in other countries. So when we work with other space agencies like ESA and the Canadian Space Agency and the Russian Space Agency, those aren't athletic trainers that are working with them. Those are exercise scientists that are working with them. And they don't have the same skill set that the athletic trainer has. So to see that international growth would be very exciting.
Yeah. You know, my program just last year hosted a student from the University of East London in the UK. So I think we're seeing more and more of those kinds of opportunities. And I think they're only going to grow. So
that's great.
I look forward to what the future holds in that environment as well.
Well, this is always really exciting. I told you he was like one of the smartest people I know.
Yeah, so maybe next March for National Athletic Training Month, we can have a little bit more about the international programs. What do you think?
Well, we'll have to see how far along the road we are, but we could see, you know, potentially multiple programs who have come to us and say we're ready to start the process. So we'll see where that goes, but I think it looks like a good idea for now.
Sounds great. Dr. Mark Merrick, if somebody wants to get a hold of you and send you some death threats, how do they do that?
Yeah, so the email for the death threats would be josh.email.
Yeah.
Actually, you can get a hold of me at Merrick, which is Merrick. So it's merrick@katie.net.
All right. And then where would you point somebody if they want to kind of follow up with some of the stuff we talked about?
I think, you know, there's a couple of good resources that are out there. Certainly the primary care definition from AAFP is a nice place to start. But the Global Forum on Innovation in Health Professions Education, which is a mouthful to say, but the IOM Global Forum has, they publish reports coming out of each of the global forums. And there's one that's Healthcare Abridged Equality from 2003. That's really the foundation of all the stuff that we're finally getting around to now in 2017 in athletic training. That'd be a great place to understand the big picture paradigm.
All right. And with it being National Athletic Training Month when this is recorded, Dr. Mark Merrick, can you give me one athletic trainer that you would like to thank?
Wow. It's hard to limit it to one. I think the one I would probably thank the most is now deceased, and his name is Dave Hufsteller. But he was my head athletic trainer when I was an athletic training student. And I think I learned more about how to take care of people, not just problems, from him than from anybody I've ever worked with.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Dr. Josh Yellen, someone wants to get a hold of you. How are they going to do that? And then who's the athletic trainer you're going to thank?
It's Merrick at... No. if somebody wants to get a hold of me, you can email me at my email, jbyellen@central.uh.edu. You can look up our MAT program, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. And a couple of athletic trainers I like to thank. I can't just pick one because I've been influenced by a few. One is Dr. Keith Friesman at Long Beach State. One is deceased Dan Bailey. He was at Long Beach State. Another one is right up the state from me, Paul Krawitz. He was at Long Beach State when I was there. And Alice McLean. You know, those are all people that have had major influences on me.
All right, very good. Saifa, an athletic trainer you would like to thank?
I'm thinking of Brittany Barker over at Rice University. She definitely helped me increase my confidence in my skills and was really a good teacher.
Very good. Melanie?
Can't really limit myself to one either. Probably have to say thank you to Dr. Knobloch and Yellen for kind of pushing us through and scaffold everything for these past 2 years. He has worked for BOC. And, of course, John Houston with UH Men's Basketball. Being there, I have the independence and just, I think, better myself to be an athletic trainer too. As just if I'm just there by myself, then I kind of know how to work my way around everything. So, yep.
All right, very good. Well, I am Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/the future. As we've talked with Dr. Mark Merrick and Dr. Josh Yellen about the future of athletic training education. And again, it's about serving the patients that are in front of us and meeting their needs with what they have right there. So again, it's not just you're not good enough because you're older. It's about meeting the needs of tomorrow. So if you want to find me on Twitter, Mr. Jeremy Jackson, or sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has all that information. And it is National Athletic Training Month, so happy National Athletic Training Month. Go and positively promote our profession and continue to grow and get better. For Jeremy Jackson, Sports Medicine Broadcast, that is a wrap.
Can I have these students with me? And one of the students that was sitting immediately to my left, Rachel Poe, when I was kind of signing off, my hard drive just stalled. It just froze, and I could not for the life of me remember her name, but I know I've seen her face.
Yeah, I've been there before.
Yeah. Yeah, Dr. Knobloch today, he was giving a test, and the internet's down. This is the best. So our internet is down at UH. It's intermittent connectivity. And so they sent an email.
I mean, the internet doesn't work. That's beautiful.
Yeah, hey, the internet's not working. And so for more updates, please check the email or please check the website. We can't.
Well, they hope your phone works.
Yeah, right.